Welcome to Metaphysical Straight Talk from the Heart. I'm your host, Atira, and I'm very excited today to have a really special author with us. He's the author, co-author of Becoming Psychic, A Spiritual Essence for Focusing Your Hidden Abilities. And his name is Stefan Kirchhoff. I'll get it right yet. And he's a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley. And he also was a freelance writer and teacher in New York City for a while, earning his doctorate in psychology. He then moved around a little bit and served at several colleges and universities in Southern California and is currently in his private practice in California. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank
it's
you.
A pleasure
Pronunciate your name, because I want to make sure they get the name right so they can go and find your book.
Well, the first name is spelled Stefan, but it's pronounced Stephen. The
Stephen,
PH
okay.
Is pronounced like a V.
Okay.
And the last name is spelled K-I-E-R-U-L-F-F, but the L is silent. We pronounce the whole thing Kirov as if it were the Kirov Ballet from Leningrad, Russia.
Great. I'm going to ask you to kind of speak up a little louder because I really want my listeners to get the information that you're going to share with us today. I got your book and I really enjoyed it because it was an interesting adventure for me to see a very linear right-brained with a very, you know, college background talk about stuff that I, you know, have no, you know, credential background for. I think that it's wonderful to see men very much opening up to this journey. So explain to me how you came to write this book.
Well, psychic things had been happening to me and around me for a number of years, and I had occasionally written down the individual stories of things, telepathy, clairvoyance, healing at a distance, precognition, and I really wasn't living in accordance with the implications of these events, and I wanted an opportunity to think about the meaning of psychic things. What does it mean that all these things happen in our world? What are the implications? What are the inferences? What does it say about how we should live?
So when you had these incidences, did you that force you then to go in search of understanding it more?
Well, yes. I think there is a limit to understanding. Nobody knows how these things happen in a scientific sense, but there are certain things that we can know about them. And I think you're right. The linear kind of left-brain academic approach is one that I am into, and my co-author, Stanley Krippner, who is a famous parapsychologist, is a master of. He's a scholar and a professor of psychology. So our book is a little different from the usual.
Yeah, I love that it's different. I love that here are two. I mean, I think men have a very different perspective sometimes from women, because women have the acceptance to have mother's intuition. You know, from a young age, we're used to, you know, our mothers knowing things and having sort of that sixth sense going on. And even though our society certainly is very big on teaching it out of us, I think it's wonderful to have people who really have, you know, a psychology background as well as parapsychology background to doing this research. I really love that your co-author is in a science now that's much more acceptable, because really, you know, that parapsychology science has been around since, you know, the 1800s in a different form, because we certainly had Oliver Lodge and many people in the SRO in England researching, you know, mediums and the psychic information. But it took a long time before it really became parapsychology.
That's true. There's been a long history to it. And my co-author, Stanley Krippner, was one of the people who changed things in parapsychology. Parapsychology was kind of stuck in the figuring out the statistics of rolling dice and praying or hoping that a certain number would come up. That was a paradigm that J.B. Rhine made famous near Duke University in North Carolina. But my co-author, Stanley Krippner, and his colleagues started in with a research project at Maimonides Medical Center involving dream telepathy.
Where is that?
It's in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, okay.
And once you get into dreams and dream telepathy, you're getting into a much more exciting and much more emotion-filled aspect of research. So I say in my book that he changed parapsychology from the black and white of tumbling dice to the technicolor of telepathic dreams.
Wow.
It was a really dramatic change, I think.
So you have these experiences that you wrote down, and you kind of kept this kind of flowing record. But what was the real turning point to perhaps get into, because some of the things you bring up in here are based on Edgar Cayce's work. What took you to the next step of, researching Edgar Cayce or getting into knowing that you could use telepathy?
Well, I got into Edgar Cayce when a friend of mine and I went to a Renaissance fair here in the Los Angeles area, which is a medieval celebration that goes on during the summers. And this was back in the days when I thought psychic stuff was bunk and hokum and so on and so forth. So he walked up to a guy at the Renaissance fair who was a seer. And he said, my friend Richard said, if you're a seer, tell me something about myself that you couldn't possibly know. And
the healthy skeptic there, huh?
That's right. So the seer looked up into the air. He was a thin guy. He was wearing leather leggings, looking very medieval. Looked up into the sky and got very contemplative and then he looked at my friend and he said, you know, you are in you're in law school now, but you're thinking about dropping out and getting into medical school. And that was exactly right, and it was something that you can't just make up or it's not due to chance. And after that, my friend told me that he was a fan of Edgar Cayce's, and I went out and I bought every book I could find by and about Edgar Cayce. Was a wonderful American psychic.
It's a wonderful place to start if you have not had any exposure to this, because I have to say I too was a Cayce convert in my 20s because I had been clairvoyant since childhood, and my mother was from Southern Baptist background, so it was very, not appreciated. And so when I found Cayce in my 20s, it was such a blessing. So I certainly can relate to your experience. Did seeing a friend who obviously until that moment had not shared that he was into Cayce, to have that experience, did that make you, want to know more, understand your experiences?
Well, at that point, I didn't have any experiences with telepathy. I had done some things, maybe one or two things with Christian Science healing. I was raised as a Christian Scientist, and my aunt had it encouraged me to believe that I, like everybody else, could heal through at a distance through what Christian Science called prayer, but somebody else might call something more complicated.
Remote healing.
It certainly wasn't a prayer of petition, but it was a prayer of action.
Completely ignorant of possibilities because you were raised with this.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
That made the leap of faith a little less of a big leap.
That's right.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
But I got in the telepathy thing with my friend. The funny thing about it was when I heard that, the first thing I said to him was, that's nonsense. That guy is a faker. I was so convinced because of my University of California indoctrination into hard, cold science that nothing psychic was real and nothing spiritual was real.
Was your background at Berkeley about psychology?
Well, I was invited into the psychology department, but I wound up majoring in anthropology, which is another social science.
Right.
But I got interested in telepathy and started playing telepathy games, mind-reading games with people at every opportunity. And I eventually, I was teaching in a private school in Beverly Hills, and one of my students was gifted in mathematics. And he and I and the rest of the class played telepathy games during a rainy day recess.
Oh, do I wish they would do that in every school. Teachers unite out there. I believe this. I wish we would teach this, you know, way of communication, of knowing, in an everyday manner. It really is part of our nature. I find it interesting here that you know, it appears to me in the book that you believe everybody can learn to do this.
Well, it's because I learned to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't born psychic. I didn't have a psychic parent.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that I worked at, and because I worked at and learned it, I figure everybody can, because I don't think I'm anybody special in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe it is a universal human capability.
What age group were you teaching this to?
This was junior high kids, so this was maybe an eighth grader.
Wow. And I got to guess that the conditions were not necessarily that conducive to doing it in a public school or a private school, either way. So what are some of the conditions that you think would make telepathic communication happen and easy?
Well, I think there are three things that facilitate telepathy. One is emergencies, because very often we get communications from people that we love or care about during emergencies. Another thing that facilitates it is relaxation. When we're deeply relaxed, or even when we're asleep, we can get telepathic communication in dreams or in hypnagogic states when we're half asleep and half awake. And the third one, I know I had three of them, I can't think of the third one, but relaxation, emergencies, the third one is joyous excitement. When you're really,
the ecstasy moment.
Yeah, when you're really revving, it just seems like there are no barriers between you and other people. That sometimes facilitates telepathy. That's what I've found.
Do you find people, when they do the telepathy, is it more in picture form or word form, or does it just vary from person to person?
Well, for me, it is pictures. When I was doing the telepathy games with that junior high school kid, he was trying to send me red, and I didn't know what color he was trying to send me, but I closed my eyes, and what I experienced was a bucket of paint sitting on my head and falling over my eyes, and it was red paint, and it was undeniable. So I said, "Are you trying to send me red?" And he said, "Yes." And that was the first telepathic hit I had that I was sure of.
I really think this is kind of connected to also seeing auras, because I think people who naturally see auras can project that to other people who are not, like, seeing the colors. I've done that in classes before where I'll say, okay, I'm going to pick out some color or see a specific color in somebody's energy field, and then the class will, I would say, 75 to 80% of the time get it.
Mm.
Because we're just, you know, we're focusing on it, we know it. And I agree with emergency telepathics. It's happened so many times for mothers. They get that knowing that something's wrong with their kid, or,
yes,
you know, or even that sense of don't get out of the car, you know,
right,
that happens. Because I think you sense the fear or the intention of that person. So I think it's true that we use this a lot more than we even give ourselves credit for.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that for some people it's hard to meditate, which would be the relaxing state. You know, the mind busyness gets in the way. Have you found any kind of technique that you like for that, to relax?
Well, deep relaxation can be brought on by autogenics, which was developed by a German doctor many years ago. And I have an autogenic training program on tape or CD that is available through my website, becomingpsychic.us. And that's only $16.95, but I find that autogenics is the...
Is that a form of hypnosis?
Well, you
I've
know...
I've never heard the technique before, I mean the term before.
It is a kind of a guided meditation. Autogenic just means you make yourself healthy. And it is something that involves listening to someone give some instructions, and the instructions are worded in such a way that your body and your mind just want to go along with the program, which is to relax more deeply than you ever have before.
I think you just brought up a really good point, too, that I have noticed now that I've done a lot of teaching seminars, and that is that the healthier or the better you care for your body, the better the instrument. And Casey was really big on this, too. You know, take care of your physical beingness, and it brings up or makes it easier to attune to that vibration that we use or we extend. And I find that very, very important, so that's a great point to bring up. You know, that the more you attune or relax or let go of that busy mind that keeps us so busy, you know, our critic, then I think that's when really we can attune or at least raise our vibration to connect better.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You can't put tea in a teacup that's already full of something else, and you can't put anything else into your mind if it's busy with racing, anxious, harried thoughts.
True.
So relaxation is a key, and taking care of your body is something that when you're healthy, you feel more relaxed, more on top of things.
Oh, and you feel safer, too. I think, you know, we have to feel safe when we're doing things, because fear is...
Hello?
I don't know. I think we just exploded there.
No,
I think we really get caught up in our fears.
I apologize. My brother put the caller online.
Oh, and tweaked the wrong button.
Hit the wrong button.
Okay. So do we have a minute, Don, before caller?
Hello?
Hello. Oops, we have a caller. Hello. How are you?
Hi,
welcome to
the
show.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Do you have a question?
Yeah. I was wondering if I could get a reading.
Well, actually, today we're really trying to talk about how this becoming psychic works, unless Dr. Kirchhoff wants to take a plunge into it.
Well, I don't do readings. I'm a psychotherapist, and I occasionally... We'll use various psychic techniques in psychotherapy, but I don't
do
cold readings.
I do have a question regarding psychotherapy.
All right.
As well. I was, if I may.
Of course.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I had been diagnosed 4 years ago with bipolar disorder.
Yes.
And I was wondering, like, I find that I've done a lot of my own self-introspection and therapy and less medication. And do you feel that it is possible to heal through prayer and through self-introspection and personal correction by being more conscientious of your actions as opposed to taking a medical route as far as drug intervention?
Well, I think both things can work. They can work individually, separately, and they can work together. I've seen people who have gotten better, gotten themselves more emotionally, under control, using both techniques, medication and psychotherapy, and other people who do both. So the answer is not one or two, it's one and two.
Right.
A
right.
And B.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think it's important to know, too, that, you know, certainly we're not putting him on the spot to diagnose and prescribe on the air. It's important to know that everybody has to take personal responsibility for their health and their healing. So thank you so much for taking care of that call. I want to kind of go back to this whole telepathic communication. In the book, it says, since there is only a one mind, all of us are telepathically communicating all the time. That's a quote by Marianne Williamson. And I think we are, don't you?
Well, yes, we may be. But it would be very confusing if we could hear everybody's thoughts all the time. Mm-hmm. So obviously we have some kind of a screening device that lets some telepathic communications through and blocks out others. But that's true of all of our senses and maybe our extrasensory apparatus that we select. We select what we attend to.
So I have to be more grateful for my autopilot at times, huh?
Well, your autopilot is doing a wonderful job.
It protects me, yeah, because there are times sometimes I'll walk in a room, it will be sensory overload because I'm hearing too much. I can so totally relate to. It's interesting to me that really telepathic, when somebody says you're telepathic, we think of a short distance, like, you know, from, you know, here to grandma's house or from here to, you know, the school or short distances. But really it has taken a new aspect when we talk about remote viewing.
Well, telepathy can be at tremendous distances. And remote viewing, clairvoyance, can be at tremendous distances, too. Distance doesn't seem to dilute the signal, the strength of the signal. And scientifically speaking, nobody knows how that is possible. That's one of the mysteries.
In Chapter 2, you talk a little bit about remote viewing. So what took you down that avenue?
Well, I took a four-day course called Silva Mind Control, which was developed by Jose Silva. And it purported to teach you to become clairvoyant. And at the end of those 4 days, to test my supposedly newly developed clairvoyance, I was given a 8.5 by 11 manila envelope and asked to see what was inside. And I saw what looked to be like a 14-year-old boy. And I reported that. And the instructor said, well, we're looking at a 16-year-old boy, but he looks 14. And he took the picture out of the manila envelope, and it was the exact kid that I had seen. I mean, I could have picked him out of a billion people. So I don't know how that was possible. It might have been just telepathy from the instructor's mind to mine, but it could have been that I actually saw the picture, even though it was hidden.
It sounds to me, in a way, you're still the skeptic here. It's like you. This is one possibility, door A. This is another possibility, door B. It sounds like it's sort of an ongoing research for you to discern, is it my instructor's reading that thought because he knew what was in the envelope, or did I really see the envelope?
Well, it may just be an academic issue, but it's one that's of interest to me.
It is hard to discern. It is hard to choose which way you're doing that.
Yeah, it's in that situation, it's impossible to know. But there have been other experiments in which people are asked to see things that presumably nobody has ever seen before.
Right.
And when they do that, then you know it's clairvoyance and not telepathy. People are, in these experiments, are given a number of degrees latitude, a number of degrees longitude, and they sometimes will tell you what is on that spot on the map, and somebody will go explore that and say, you know, that's exactly what was there.
Has this impacted your practice?
My practice of psychotherapy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it has in a couple of ways. One way is when people come to me and they say they're psychic, I don't poo-poo them.
Thank you, God. Thank you. You know, because
too.
It's true. You know, Doreen Virtue was in the same kind of arena as you in that she's a psychotherapist and actually worked at a lockdown facility. And if you came in talking about spirit or God or visions, you know, they instantly, in those days, early days, gave you good drugs and gave you a nice place to sleep through it or work through it.
Right.
And now, you know, she's doing teaching about, because she had a personal experience, she could no longer discount it. And it really feels like for you too, now that you have your own research, that you're much more willing to listen and discern, is it schizophrenia or dual personality, or is it something more?
Yes. I mean, schizophrenia does exist.
Absolutely. Multi-personality does exist too.
Yes. But the ability to interact with mysterious realms exists too. So we have to take that into account and not mislabel people.
Well, you get extra A marks for me for being open to that. It's so wonderful to hear that, because I do think there's so much still that we have yet to explain. You know, I remind people that at one time it was a scientific fact that the world was flat. So science is ever changing, you know, as are all the sciences. of, you know, doctors, psychology, everything. There's so much that is yet to be discovered in the known world and unknown world, and in the mind of us. I mean, I really don't think science has proven how we think.
No, there is a lot that has to be figured out, and one thing that hasn't been figured out about psychic stuff is how on earth the information is transmitted. Nobody has any idea, really, scientifically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful mystery.
So you studied this telepathic, which kind of took you then into remote viewing. So it's been an interesting journey. And then did this take or activate your interest in distance healing again? You spoke earlier about your aunt talking about distance healing. Then did it all start becoming a journey of one thing being layered on top of the other?
Well, in the Silva Mind Control course, there was an approach to distant healing that was taught that involved visualizing a sick person becoming well in concrete physical details. And I was looking for an opportunity to use that technique. And several years after I took the course, I became acquainted with a woman whose sister had been in bed for 10 years with an illness. And I said, wait, don't tell me any more about that, because I want to try, first of all, psychic diagnosis and psychic healing with her.
Do you believe it's a permission thing? Do you ask permission?
I do.
I do, too. I believe that. I think it's very important for anyone that's listening to know that we do believe that is, you know, we as spiritual beings should not invade another one's space. And so
absolutely.
I think it's important to always ask permission. And, you know, most of the time anybody who's sick is going to say, please, you know, let's try anything. But certainly, go on. So you ask permission.
Well, the first thing I did was a diagnosis. I relaxed myself and got into the space where you can tune into these things. And I saw that the woman, I visualized her, and I saw that the woman had a problem in her chest, and in her lungs. So I asked her sister, is your sick sister a smoker? Has she got problems from smoking? And she said no, but she does have a fungus in her lungs.
Now, did you just see this, or did you actually have a sense of pressure as well?
No, I didn't have a sense of pressure. I just saw it as a kind of a... I saw it and sensed it.
Good.
But I did not feel it. Some people do feel.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that, you know, because we're really hoping to teach here today, I encourage people to see it and visualize and see it and sense it rather than take it on and feel it. Because sometimes then when we feel it, we don't let go of it. So
well,
that's amazing. So you felt it. You got confirmation from the person.
Yes,
sister.
Yeah. She had some kind of a 14-letter disease that involves fungus in the lungs.
Wow.
I said, well, you know, I learned how to do healing at a distance in this course, and why don't you ask your sister if she wants me to heal her? Now, the thing about this that interests me from this perspective 20 years later is I was totally confident that I could do it, which seems a little strange now because the woman had been in bed for 10 years, but I didn't say, you know, do you want me to try? I said, does your sister want me to do it? I don't know what made me so confident, but...
I think it's important, though, to know that... I think it's important, and I think that's the difference between it being successful sometimes and not, is the knowing that it can happen versus I'm trying.
Right. Well, I wasn't trying.
Kind of infers
doing.
That it might not happen.
Yeah. Well, the sister said yes, so what I did is every other day I spent 20 minutes imagining her lungs and cleaning them out as if with a pipe cleaner, just wringing the gunk out from her lungs. And every time I did it, they got clearer. And after about a month, I started writing to her and getting letters back from her. And she was getting better. She had been scheduled for surgery, and the surgery was postponed.
Right.
And at some point when I was working on her lungs after a month or two, they were entirely clear, so she wasn't out of bed yet. She was still still in the hospital, but...
Well, 10 years in bed, is the body would be pretty weak.
Yeah, but what I said to her is, I wrote her to her and I said, you are healed at the level that these healings take place, whether you want to call it the spiritual level or the etheric level or whatever it is. And it may take a while for it to manifest in your body, but it's done, so you can be confident that your body is going to show this healing. And then I signed off as a healer, and about a month later I got a call from her sister saying that the woman who had been in bed for 10 years was out and about and was going to come out to California to visit her sister.
Wonderful.
And when she did come out, she gave me a call. She asked me what I did and how I did it, and I told her, and she thanked me. She asked me if I wanted a piece of cut glass as a work of art, as a gift. And I turned it down because I thought, I didn't do anything. The mysterious power of the universe did this.
When you did this, did you do it? Did you concentrate on her at the same time every day?
I think it was in the afternoon, but I didn't deliberately do it at exactly the same.
But
hour
I do
or
think
minute.
Being consistent every day is important.
Do you think so?
I think that it builds the energy, and I think also how we project our thoughts. You know, the body likes repetition.
Mm-hmm.
In the work that I do, I really find that I tend to like to work in a pattern where me and spirit are in agreement of something. And because I do think we make agreements with the universe, this is my personal perspective. But I think consistency, when you're trying something like this, you can't be wishy-washy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it dilutes the accuracy or the ability for the receiver or the intent to facilitate in a consistent way.
Well, as it happened...
Did you just have a knowingness when it was done?
Well, it was a matter of visualizing. When I saw the woman's lungs in my
clear.
Imagination, they were clear, whereas when I'd started out, I couldn't see them except with junk in them, with fungus in them.
Did you have an absolute, clear vision of what lungs should look like because you have studied it, or...?
No, I just have a layperson's ideas of lungs.
Wow. So anybody could work on a particular person's body with just a sense of the knowingness of the physical body versus, having pictures of everything.
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but that may be the case.
Wonderful. Exciting. So what about, then, in the book you were talking about psychic kinesis, which is really sort of the bending of metal and thing. The only person I really remember too much about was Uri Geller. I actually happened to be on his radio show a few years ago. He was in London, and it was a phone radio show. And I was very excited because I had seen him bend spoons and do things like that for a long, long time. And so it was kind of exciting to communicate with him. So how did you get into understanding the psychokinetic energy?
Well, psychokinesis is something that may be involved in spiritual healing at a distance, because it may be what you're doing is bending the body that you're working on. Speaking of bending metal, you're affecting the body at a distance.
Cellular level?
Pardon me?
At a cellular level?
Well, yeah, at a cellular level or whatever level that you're working on. It may be psychokinetic is the way it works. Nobody can prove it or disprove it, but it's a way of thinking about it. But with Uri Geller, I was fascinated to... I wanted to see him bend metal, and he came to Santa Monica, where I have an office here in California, and he had a program called The Mind Can Do Anything. And I spent all day sort of gearing up for going to that, didn't talk to anybody, saved up my energy, and when I got there, I eventually moved down to about the sixth row from the stage, and when Uri decided to start bending keys, he asked people to throw up house keys from the audience. There were about 100 keys on the stage. He came out into the audience to, quote, get some energy, end quote, and where he got the energy was right above my head. Stopped right in front of me and put the key right above my head and started bending it, apparently psychically, just about a foot from my eyes. So I got my wish. I got to see him bend metal, but it came true at such a level that I couldn't believe it. I couldn't even have hoped for.
Nice manifestation.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah, I love those things. You know, that's really what I call those synchronicities coming true. When we put out the intent that we want to experience something, and then, you know, to our amazement, it turns out better than we could have even manifested.
I never would have dreamed of that. But it was exactly what I wanted, and he bent that key just by holding it in one hand and using a finger over it. He never touched the key with the finger that was supposedly doing the bending, and the key bent up towards his finger. At least it appeared to. Now, I have to be somewhat skeptical here, but I've talked to and read accounts of magicians who have... because some people say Geller is nothing but a magician. But professional magicians who have seen him work say that they don't know of any way to produce that kind of thing through a magic trick. And they think something psychic or special is going on.
Well, I really have to say, I think a lot of the skeptics and magicians of the world have some of that ability, too. I mean, if we all have it, I mean, it's there.
Well, that's true. Yes,
you know,
they do.
I mean, we affect things every day, whether we were conscious of it or not. I mean, you know, lots of times I think we like to claim, you know, we're on autopilot and it wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we affect everybody every day.
Mm-hmm. Our subconscious is still operating, even if we're not consciously trying to do things.
So what is your dreams or hopes for this book? Why did you write it?
Well, I wrote it for several reasons. One was to just come to terms with what had happened to me. The other was to get a scientific perspective, which I got from Stanley Krippner's contributions. I wrote about 80%, he wrote 20%. It's kind of a dialogue between a psychic, myself, and a scientist, Dr. Krippner. And the third reason was to help other people become psychic, because I give detailed instructions about how to become telepathic, clairvoyant, how to do healing at a distance, and how to see the future.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice little workbook. It gives kind of outlines so people can try a lot of the techniques on their own, which I like.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people want you to buy their stuff, you know, their tapes, or you know, they're more of a marketing rather than here's some hands-on. Try it, and if you like it, we can talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love that you, and I also love something really wonderful that you did, and that is that you absolutely gave people the opportunity to look into other clairvoyants. In the back, you talk about people wanting to go in search of themselves and to go to the area and experience, you know, ask questions, but to have a reading, but to go to a source that has some readers who have already been really, really tested. And that's one thing I have to say about the ARE. They do really test their clairvoyants and psychics before you're listed with them. And so I liked your attitude of, in other words, experience a good reading and then go from there with, you'll have more questions. And I believe that when you have a good reading, you get some answers, but you wind up with 20,000 more questions, which energizes you to go and want to learn more.
Yes, and a good psychic reading will get rid of your skepticism or certainly punch a bunch of holes in it.
It's true. It's true. And I also have to say, too, I really tell my clients, too, when you call me, I tell them right up front, they don't get to talk. They get to say yes, no, and I don't know for the first part of reading, because I want them to know that I'm getting this from spirit and they're not going later, oh, God, I helped her. Oh, my God, I just told her everything.
Well, that's wonderful for skeptics. It's a wonderful format.
It is a good format. And the other thing that I think is very important is to know that there's a lot of the readers that have been screened by the ARE in particular, they have really good policies about, you know, refunds, about being honest and in integrity about if I'm not the one for you, I tell them right up front. If I start to do a reading and I feel I'm not getting the right information, I tell them right then, you know what, I'm refunding your money. I'm not the reader for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because every reader connects differently with every particular situation. So I don't think everybody can read everybody. I think there is a compatibility there at some level too. And I think you talk about actually how, you know, sometimes I think people can connect and sometimes they can't, even with telepathic or psychic kinesis or any of those abilities. Everybody has good days and bad days.
It's true. You know, one of the interesting things that my co-author has been involved in is researching what accounts for good days and bad days, and one of the factors seems to be sunspot activity. When there are more sunspots, there's more radiation coming from the sun, and it may interfere to a certain extent with the transmission of psychic information. Because most of the days when psychics have good days are days when there is low sunspot activity.
Oh my God, that's fascinating!
Isn't that something?
Aren't sunspots also affect? Don't they affect like cellular things and radio waves and stuff too? I thought I have heard that somewhere that sometimes it affects, if there's big sun flares, it affects the radio waves and things.
It's true. Sometimes radio transmissions at certain frequencies can be entirely disrupted, entirely knocked out by solar flares and sunspots.
I think I really love this guy, this scientist of yours. I have to say, you know, it's interesting to me because in spiritualism, reading old spiritualist work, they'll talk about that the ethers were not conducive on certain times, meaning the atmosphere.
Right.
They would talk about how, you know, on certain nights, if there was thunderstorms or certain things going on, the spirits might not, you know, communicate as well. And yet then other nights, you know, when it was a clear night and the moon was full and it was, quote-unquote, quiet, almost quiet before a storm, it would almost be like the energy would be electrified. Like before the storm, conditions were conducive, but when the lightning started, it dissipated something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost, again, agreeing with this whole sunspot thing. Fascinating.
Well, there are a lot of influences, and some of them have been researched, and some of them we have anecdotal evidence for.
I'm curious if your the other co-writer has done any research on clairvoyants and psychics who affect electrical things, because I have a very hard time with cell phones will not hold charges, lights, you know, turn off and on. I had a portable phone. We went through 9 of them until we found out I went away. It was fine.
Well, I've learned that I have to be careful about what I think, and particularly impatience, annoyance, anger when I'm around computers. And I don't know whether it's my imagination or whether there really is an effect, but it seems to have been. So I'm cautious in that regard. And apparently there are people and times when those transmissions do affect electrical apparatus.
Yeah, I noticed John Edwards said when I saw him on stage that they always have at least 3 or 4 backup mics that he affects them too. So it makes me feel better. I think it's how we expand our energy in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a rule. My husband says, no, do not touch my computer. What you choose to do to your computer is your business, but don't touch mine. So it's interesting that there is, I think, sort of this electromagnetic charge that has to do with this quote-unquote vibration or whatever that we use, and especially it would appear when you see the bending of keys or the fixing of watches. That's another thing Uri Geller's really known for.
Yes, yeah.
Repairing watches. I actually, he was on TV one time, and I had a watch that had not worked since I was probably about 14, and I thought, well, you know, this could be fun, right? And I put it out there, and it did. It ran for like 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was broken. I knew it actually couldn't be fixed. It was an old Cinderella watch that the watch repairman said absolutely can't be fixed. But it was great. It ran for like 3 or 4 days.
One of the interesting things that the skeptics say is that the reason those watches work is that this is the first time you've held it for 14 years. You hold it in front of the TV while Uri's doing his thing, and the warmth of your hands gets transmitted into the gummy works and loosens up the gummy stuff, and the watch starts working. That's a naturalistic explanation. I don't mean to rule out psychic influences, but I just thought I'd throw that in.
I don't think so, because I had handled that watch, and mucked with it and shook it trying to get it to work before. I can't buy that one. I'm not with you on that one.
All right, I'm just telling you.
You lose on that one for me. And also because I at the same time had told several other friends to do, you know, if they had it to experience, to see, and all of the watches worked.
Well,
and one of my friends was really skeptical. Like, he, you know, put it on a tray, set it in front. He didn't touch it. So, I don't know. There's something a little more going on there.
When I saw Uri Geller do his thing in Santa Monica, he had, I don't know how many dozens and maybe 50 watches that weren't working up on the stage people put up there. And a lot of them were working at the end of the show. So something's going on.
So are you doing ongoing kind of research? Do you have a group that maybe you're working with in this manner?
I am not, but I keep hoping to set one up. It is one of my interests to get a research group started in Santa Monica, West LA area. If anybody's listening in and is interested or wants to get involved from your area, just contact me. Contact information, you can go to becomingpsychic.us and I'll tell you how to get in touch with me.
You will also have some information posted on the www.bbsradio.com as well, so make sure you check on, as well as my website, which is angelscribe.com, so we want to make sure that you have lots of roads to find your way to this book. Now, is your co-author currently doing research?
Well, he has, for the last number of years, been... for many years, the guy who takes the research that others have done and gives you an annual compendium for parapsychologists, he did that for a number of years. And he is teaching at a graduate school in San Francisco, Humanistic Psychology Graduate School, Saybrook Institute. I don't know whether he has any research programs in parapsychology going right now. He has published, as I say, recently about the sunspot phenomena, and he's been working with a Canadian scientist, Michael Persinger, on that research. So he's got his fingers in a number of pies.
It would be really wonderful to see him, maybe, and Gary Swartz from the University of Arizona, who has done a lot of work on researching mediums like John Edward, Alison Dubois. He's researched a lot of psychic information. It would be wonderful to see them do something together,
mm-hmm.
because it really seems like they have different aspects of the puzzle that could be uniquely put together for a really great research book.
Well, maybe that'll happen.
That would be exciting, yeah. So as you've gone on this journey, what is the one thing that you feel maybe personally like was a big aha for you? Was there one incident that particularly made you go, oh my God?
Well, I think all of these, everything psychic that's occurred in my life has been a kind of an aha experience. So maybe the biggest aha was the first time I saw the future. I really thought that was totally impossible. After all, the future hasn't happened yet, so how could anybody see it?
The right brain, and you went crazy, I bet.
Warning! The first time I saw the future, I thought I was crazy, but then it happened so often.
But you knew that you were the psychotherapist, so you couldn't be, right?
Well, this was before I was a psychotherapist. But it happened so often after that, I knew it wasn't just my imagination. I knew my gears hadn't just slipped, but something was going on. Nobody can explain it. Nobody knows how it happens, but the fact is that it does happen. It's one of the most interesting of psychic phenomena.
Yeah, I think September 11th was a big, for so many clairvoyant people, for so many psychics, for so many readers, for so many lay people, it was almost like what happened for many, many people before the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
So many people had precognition not to get on the Titanic.
And did you have precognition?
Yeah, I had flight or fright for about 5 days before panic.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how you go through the Rolex in your brain. Is it my relatives? You know, as a clairvoyant, when you don't have a place, but you have a fear. I started going through all my family members, what was going on. I did see planes, and I called everybody, are you flying? What's going on? You know, but I couldn't put, I didn't put New York into it. I put a tall building that didn't make sense to me into it. And because I have a business that I imported from Egypt for a long time, I would see flashes of what I thought was Egypt, which was probably not now, was probably something to do with the Middle East. But it's like sometimes it's like fragments, and so it's like trying to put, you know, a 3,000-piece puzzle together.
I know what you mean. I had premonitions about 9/11 before it happened for about, I don't know how long, 6 months or a year. I would look up just into the sky, and I would feel disaster coming. And I had the strongest impulse to short stocks in the stock market, which would have been a good idea because the stock market fell about 1,000.
We never really get that one, do we, as psychic and clairvoyant people? It's like that whole money thing or stock thing or lotto ticket thing does not seem to work for us.
Well, it worked for me one time. I had a dream in which a voice in the dream just told me what was going to happen in the I followed the advice in the dream, and I made enough money to buy a new car.
Yay! Congratulations.
Which is something I really needed at the time.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah, once in a while we behave ourselves and follow through. Oh, I hate to get close to the end of this interview, but I want to finish up with talking about the precognition thing, because our seeing things before they happen in the future. I think it's very frustrating because you can have that whole pending disaster feeling, and it's not like you can call somebody and say, hey, a friend of mine one time said, well, why don't you call somebody? And I said, and who would you call? You know, the truth is they're not really where you can call and say, you know, I think I got something going on here. And yet there's a part of me that says, if there is a center like that, it would be good, because if a lot of people are calling, we're going to know something's up.
Yeah, they had a proposed government program that was going to run on that line of possibility. I used to have a central premonitions registry, I think it was in New York, that would take in premonitions and kind of tabulate them against what happened in the future. I don't know whether that's still operating.
Because about 3 weeks before, I had messages on my phone machine from so many other clairvoyants. They say, something's up at here. I don't know what it is. I have this feeling. I'm like, you know, is anybody else, you know, and you pool this, like, you know, 17 other clairvoyants, because when you're in the business, you know a lot of them. And we're all having this thing, but none of us know. And, of course, standing watching the news on September 11th, we're all, you know, going like, man, why couldn't we put all those pieces together? Why didn't it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, there are a lot of mysteries about...
I also think there might have been more than one site, too, because it was interesting that some people really saw California, and then the rest of us saw New York.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting, isn't it?
It really
is. It is that kind of, you know, telepathic thing.
Yeah, we might have been tuning into the plans of the hijackers.
I know. That morning when I saw the first plane hit and then the second, I don't even remember it, but my husband said I kind of went into a screaming, where's the other plane, where's the other plane, where's that plane, there's two more planes. And I don't,
sense.
To me at all, remember it. But my husband said, you know, he was trying to calm me down that there was only two planes. I go, no, there's more. And but there's something that we tap into that, you know, so much is still not explained. But you helped explain some things. It's wonderful to see a male point of view, especially someone who has, you know, studying psychotherapy, you know, really gives a credibility to this, because it's not just a guy who all of a sudden had his personal experiences, but obviously used the mind of reason and science to, you know, okay, go into a field that had to really look at what this is and isn't.
Yeah, I used to teach research methods to people who were becoming psychologists in graduate school. So I got a training in logic and applied to mysteries and unknown things. And I try to bring that into the fore in the book, Becoming Psychic. I hope I did a reasonable job at it, and I think my co-author, Stanley Krippner, is one of the best at that. I mean, it's kind of, you have to juggle things to be open on the one hand, but not foolishly open on the other hand.
Sometimes, you know, I do feel like I'm a double-blind experiment.
You're a double-blind experiment.
A double-blind experiment, you know. Sometimes it is like, you know, one reason scientists do double-blinds is that they actually found out that the mind of the researcher can affect the outcome of
the thing. This is exactly true.
So there's a part of that whole thing that happens when you do this kind of work that, you know, you have to understand why scientists do double-blind experiments, why they repeat experiments over and over to see, you know, how are the statistics falling and how is this interaction all happening? So I think it's an incredible science yet to be discovered, you know, and explained, all this. I think we're, you know, as we evolve, it evolves, and certainly having you and your colleagues' input is certainly changing the world as we know it, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on my show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What I love about this, too, is I think it gives men permission to go in search of much more. The more that we hear men, especially with scientific backgrounds or medical backgrounds, being willing to share their experiences to tweak that little, I don't know what I really think, chord in us, it opens the door for other men to go, oh, I think, let me think about this. Let me research it. Let me be at least open to it, because I really believe that it's where we're going. I hope in the future, in our schools, like the experiment that you did with your students, I love that so much when I hear it. I think that is the future for us.
Well, it's certainly something, I think Edgar Cayce said, we live in a time where spiritual influences must come to rule the world. And we certainly need spiritual influences around now.
Well, I also think that as people study spirituality and go in search of whatever that is for them, they also find out how much our mind affects everything, our thoughts. As we think, so we create. And I think we are really realizing how much of that really happens in our life, whether we're conscious of it or not. And the more conscious we are, the more conscious choices we make, the less autopilot in some ways could be a good thing, because then we begin to take personal responsibility and make conscious choices about being more spiritual.
Well, you know,
being open-minded, at least.
You sound like an advertisement for psychotherapy, because that's what we try to do in therapy, is to get people to realize what they're manifesting and creating subconsciously, and to make conscious choices about changing and creating what they do want in their lives.
I think it's true, because, you know, sometimes we get stuck on what our parents did, what our peers did, what our, you know, our school upbringing, our religious upbringing, whatever our history is, whatever is in our cosmic basement, so to speak. And sometimes I don't think we get to say, is this really about me in this moment and who I am versus all that stuff that comes with us. So in a way, you know, as you become more spiritual and become more co-creator, then, you know, you have to leave that baggage behind, which is really what your science does, is helps everybody leave their cosmic baggage behind.
Absolutely.
And explore the possibilities and wonder of who we really are. Thank you again so much for being on my show. It's been absolutely a pleasure. I hate to say goodbye, but please state your website again so people can get and look for the book.
www.becomingpsychic.us.
Yeah. Check it out. And I love in the back, he really has some rules of checking out and having a good reading, how to facilitate a good reading. He has a lot of the ARE's psychics in the back, and they have been researched by the ARE. And so, again, thank you so much, and I hope today we have opened your mind and your heart to possibilities. Remember to let your heart light shine bright, to light your way and to light the way for others. Have a great evening and lots of angel blessings. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.